joint tenants, there are some other things that relate to that that don't to tenants by the entirety. Judgments and liens against a joint tenant can attach that joint tenant's interest, whereas tenants by the entirety, it can only attach the property after one of them has passed away. So there are a lot of ramifications.
But in a sort of, again, the classic home purchase,
right,
where a married couple buys a house, they want it to pass to, if one of them passes away,
right,
they want it to go pass to the other spouse automatically. And how is that accomplished under Oregon law now?
Well, Mr. Chair, where they take title and it says husband and wife after their name, there's no problem. Where it doesn't say anything after their name, if they go to court, the surviving spouse will end up getting it if they were in fact married. But it might require them going to court because there may be other heirs who claim an interest in half that property. And all this does is make the law clear that if they are husband and wife and it's deeded to them, there's no special language required for them to hold that way.
Chair McPherson.
Representative Kahn.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I have a question on the definition of joint tenancy. Up in the summary, it says clarifies that existing language abolishing joint tenancy. What is joint tenancy?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative,
I mean, does it mean a marriage certificate?
Joint tenants would not necessarily have to be married. In California, if you take two people who are not married and say joint tenants, they have survivorship automatically by using that language.
Okay.
In Oregon, it's abolished by statute. It has been.
If I have two siblings that are looking at purchasing a piece of property, okay.
If they want survivorship, if they express that in the deed, then that's fine. But without expressing it, they each own an undivided interest as tenants in common.
Mr. Nelson, let me state what I think that is the case, is that at common law, joint tenancy had this freak to it. That is, it created automatically, without doing anything more, if you said we're joint tenants, it meant that if one dies, the other gets all the property. And the way Oregon law now works is that you have to say that explicitly. You don't get that outcome just by saying we're joint tenants. You have to say with right of survivorship or something that explicitly states that it will pass on death to the other. Am I correctly stating that?
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. Joint tenancy is abolished by statute in Oregon, so using just those words wouldn't accomplish your goal. You must say with survivorship, or there's some language from the Robinson case that is often used as well.
Okay, and am I understanding that as a result of this bill, we clarified that if it's not real property, if it's personal property, shares of stock or a thing, something that's not ground, that it would have that consequence, that if you say we're joint tenants, it means if one of you dies, the other automatically gets the property.
Mr. Chair, this bill relates only to real property, and joint tenancy in stock or other personal property would not be affected at all.
Well, then I'm confused. What's the effect of, if it doesn't have any effect on non-real property, then what's the clarification that makes joint tenancy applicable only to tenancies in real property?
Well, Mr. Chair, the correction that was made to the law in 1983 was to add language after the words tenancy by the entirety, to say, and you'll see it in the italics portion of the bill, to a husband and wife as such. Some people interpret that to say that you have to have the words husband and wife after their names in order to create that. The courts have never ruled that way. They've said if they are in fact husband and wife, then they take a sentence by the entirety. This bill eliminates that language and clarifies it.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions, committee?
It's probably clear.
Yes.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, because I'm just trying to make sure I understand. When I look at subsection A, thank you, Mr. Chair, by the way, creates a tendency in common unless, okay, so if two people are on a real piece of property, it's automatically going to be a tenant in common. So they would own their individual shares. If there's two people, it'd be 50-50, unless it says 60-40 or whatever. Am I correct on that, based on this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, you are correct.
Okay,
the default ownership is tenancy in common.
Okay. Then if my wife and I are on that piece of property, okay, versus another lady and I, if my wife and I are on that piece of property,
it's in trouble.
It's not tenants in common automatically. It would be husband and wife as long as we prove that we are married. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, that's also correct. A deed to a couple who are married will create a tenancy by the entirety without having to state that.
Okay. Today, I'm going to go back. So today, if my wife and I are on that title, what's the difference versus if this law is passed?
Okay, Mr.
That's
Chair.
Where I need to get clear in my head.
If I were advising you under the present law, I would tell you to be sure to put husband and wife after your name. Then there would be no question. If you don't put husband and wife after your name, you still take a sentence by the entirety. But if one of you dies and that deceased person has other heirs, they could challenge that. They'd end up losing, but it would cause a problem.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just as a comment, what we're attempting to do here is to clarify probably, and there have been a lot of deeds that have been crafted and created that have left out the significant language, because that is an area that I have had some experience and created the problems that you're trying to address.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Flores. And thank you, Mr. Nelson. If there are no further questions, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2365 and open a work session on House Bill 2365.
We better do this as consent. This should be a consent.
Yeah, let's explain this one.
I'm wondering, Representative Flores, because your prior experience with this, whether you might want to make a motion, and I think it might, even though it looks pretty simple here, it may still be good to have a carrier, just in case there are any questions. Would you be willing to perform those functions?
Chair, I would be happy to move House Bill 2365 to the floor with a pass recommendation if you feel it needs carrier.
Well, is your feeling that it does not, that it would, if we present it?
Well, considering perhaps the extent of the question here, I would be happy to be the carrier.
Okay. Representative Forrest has moved House Bill 2365 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonnici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Yes.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Koch?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed excused? Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnes?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. House Bill 2365 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be carried by Representative Flores. I'll close up the work session on House Bill 2365. We now, since we're past the noticed hour of 9:30, we'll move on to the remainder of the agenda. And among those, although I had said I was going to take these in numerical order, I would like to jump first to House Bill 2192. I think it's probably the quickest of those three, and Council Kalmanson is first in that one, and we'll excuse him once we've finished with it. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2192. We have Patricia Baxter from DHS.
Morning,
section.
92.
Ms. Baxter.
Good morning, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Baxter. I'm the administrator of the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery with the Department of Human Services. House Bill 2192 is intended to simply clarify the priority of DHS claims in estates for care of institutionalized clients. Some changes were made to ORS 115-125, both in the 2001 session and in the 2005 session. In 2001, Department of Corrections was added to the statute so that they could file claims in estates for decedents that had been institutionalized in state corrections facilities. In 2005, the statute was again amended to reflect some changes in the priority of DHS claims. In those changes, the institutional claims were left out. So the intent of this change is simply to clarify the priority of the institutional claims for DHS clients or former clients that have been housed in our state mental institutions. There is a paragraph in statute that specifies the Department of Corrections claims that does not, however, mention specifically the DHS state institutions. So that's the purpose of this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Are there any questions for Ms. Baxter?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Ms. Baxter. I wonder if you could talk about the extent of claims that the DHS does submit in these types of cases. Are we talking about hundreds or dozens or thousands of people?
Certainly.
Or dollars? Thank you.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, we filed in 2005 about 200 claims and about the same amount in 2006. So that gives you an idea. It's not a huge volume. We don't receive a lot of funds, unfortunately, from these claims either. Usually the estates in these cases are not very large. So it's not a great number.
A follow-up, please?
You may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what is the approximate amount of a typical claim? You said about 200 claims.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, I don't have an average amount of claims. What I can tell you is in 2005, we were able to recover $279,000 and a little bit more than that in 2006. So, again, Not a lot of money here. Any funds that are not recovered from the estate are then funded by the general fund. So this is a direct repayment to the general fund.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Yeah.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And these are claims that are primarily filed under small estate administration proceedings. Are they?
Chairman and Representative Flores, it would be a combination. It really depends on the size of the estate. We also have another unit within my office that handles Medicaid claims. Theirs are generally in large estates and not in the small claims setting. So it's hard to give you a straightforward answer on that. It depends.
Any other questions? If not, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2192 and open a work session on House Bill 2192. Committee, this looks pretty straightforward. This looks like it's just a clarification and would I think be suitable for the consent calendar. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2192 out with a due pass to the consent calendar.
You've heard the motion from Representative Barker to move House Bill 2192 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion of the motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Campbell?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Pump?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed, excuse. Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye.
House Bill 2192 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2192. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2179. We have Harry Gilmore from DHS as our first witness.
Thank you.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Harry Gilmore, manager of the Tactical Assistance Unit for the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2179. House Bill 2179 would permit the Department of Human Services to run criminal background checks on alleged perpetrators of child abuse and neglect or other adults who live at the location or frequent the location where abuse is alleged to have occurred prior to providing the alleged perpetrator or others with written notice that the criminal background check will be conducted. Currently, the department does have authority to run criminal background checks in the context of a child abuse investigation. However, the law requires us to provide the individual with written notice before we run that check. And where this becomes a problem is when we initially receive a report of child abuse, typically by telephone, and we're at the critical point of decision making about whether or not to respond in person to the location where the abuse is alleged to have occurred. In other words, to continue our investigation. And sometimes having criminal history information can be critical to making that decision. For example, if we receive a report of child abuse that is fairly inconclusive and there's not enough factual information for us to warrant going out in person to investigate the allegation, but then if we were to learn that the alleged perpetrator had a recent conviction for something like delivery and manufacture of methamphetamine or a serious assault charge or something else of that nature, that may be in some instances the deciding factor as to whether or not we would respond in person to the report of abuse or neglect. Having that information about criminal background can also be critical to our decision making with regard to worker safety. If we do decide to have a worker respond to the report in person, knowing about the criminal history of the individuals involved and the individuals who live at the location of the alleged abuse can help us into determining what kind of safety precautions we should take before sending a worker to that location. Again, if we know that an individual has a history of violent behavior, or we know that the person has a history of manufacture of methamphetamine or something like that that may pose a hazard to the worker, then that might increase that might determine whether or not we involve law enforcement in our response to the report. As I said previously, the department already has the authority to conduct these checks in the context of child abuse and neglect investigations. All this bill would do was would allow us to run the checks sooner in the process before we provide written notice. Now, when we were developing this legislative concept, some concerns were raised about the due process available to people who are subject to these kinds of criminal background checks in this context. And so we modified our original concept to include language that will still require the department to provide these individuals with written notice, but just at a slightly later time than we are required to do so now. In other words, we'll still be providing written notice to individuals whenever we decide to continue our investigation of the alleged abuse or neglect, but we will not be providing that notice prior to making contact with the individual. There are some proposed -1 amendments to this bill. In the original draft, there was language in this bill that was inserted to reflect recent changes to federal law. The federal law affects a number of state agencies, and affected agencies are coordinating their analysis of the federal changes, and until that work is completed, we're seeking to remove that language from this bill until the work, the analysis that is going on in cooperation with other state agencies is completed. And so we're recommending or seeking that the committee approve the Dash 1 amendments and pass the amended version of the bill. Thank you, and I can answer any questions.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gilmore, this is just in the placement of children, or does this have anything to do with the entire bill requiring reporting sexual abuse, suspected sexual abuse?
Representative McPherson, Chair Wisner, could you repeat the question? I'm not sure I understand.
Yeah. You know, we have the bill that requires certain people in certain positions to report suspected child abuse. So would this be enforced then, or is this only in consideration of placement of children? Or is it? I don't understand the mechanics of where this fits in who are we going to do this on? Is it people that I report as, you know, one of my constituents says, you know, their daughter's being sexually abused by an ex or something like that? Would you do this criminal background investigation?
Yes, the criminal background checks that this bill addresses are those that occur at the point that we receive a report of child abuse, regardless of the source of that report. And again, we already have the authority as an agency to run checks in that context when we receive a report of child abuse or neglect. All that this bill does would allow us to run those checks prior to giving the subject of the check written notice that the check's going to occur. And then if we continue our investigation, then written notice would be provided to the individual at some point subsequent to the initial report.
Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I think it's a great idea to crack down on child abuse. I have a concern, however, about the language on the top of page 2, where it says, the way that I read this, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you could use this, get the information without giving prior notice to an individual who resides in or frequents the alleged victim's residence. And so I'm concerned, without a definition of frequency alleged victim's residence, it looks like somebody, grandma who comes over to visit, for example, frequents the alleged victim's residence, and is there any indication that is somebody who you would go after in this, or you could go after in this, because of the breadth of that language? I understand if it's somebody who's an alleged perpetrator, absolutely, but there's nothing in that language that indicates that somebody who frequents the alleged victim's residence should be a suspect.
Representative Bonamici, Chair McPherson, oftentimes when we receive a report of abuse, the alleged perpetrator may not be specifically identified. In other words, you may have a report that there's drug activity happening at a residence and that children may be in danger as a result of that, and so you may not know exactly who the alleged perpetrator is. And our determination about how to respond to the report may involve checking more than one individual. And so what the amendment seeks to do is provide us with the authority to run those checks. And again, I should mention that the department already has the authority to run checks of this nature, and we're not limited under our current authority to checking only the alleged perpetrator in a report. We have the authority under our current statutes and current rules to run a background check on anyone located at the residence where the abuse is alleged to have occurred, and we're doing that now. The only thing that this amendment would do is allow us to run the check prior to providing that person with written notice, And then if we decide to continue our investigation, in other words, the only time we wouldn't be giving written notice is if we decide to close the case right at that point. We determine that it's not worth going out and investigating further to make an in-person visit, and that we would close the case at the point of the report. In any other instance, we'd be providing the individual with written notice that the report had been run, and they would be advised of their rights to challenge the their criminal record if they feel that it is inaccurate, and then there are other specific rights under the law that they would be advised of in writing.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to be kind of follow up on Representative Wisnett's comment. If he calls and said that I'm abusing, he heard some screaming or abuse at my house, what you're telling me is that all of a sudden you can take my name, phone number, whatever, and go in and do, this allows you to just go in and do that background check on me or whoever's in that house without notifying me, and it becomes part of now a public record on that case. Is that what we're talking about here?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, members of the committee. We already have the authority as a department to run criminal background checks in this
context.
I understand
that.
And it's true the law does give us the authority to run the check prior to giving written notice. But again, if there would not be a continuing record of the case if we did not continue our investigation. And that's the only point at which any record of the criminal background check would be entered into the record. If we were to continue our investigation, and then we would be supplying the individual with written notice that the check had been run, and that end of their rights for challenging the information if they choose to do so. If we do not continue the investigation, the law already contains requirements about destroying any copy of a criminal background check. And in most cases, when these checks are run in our local offices, the check is run electronically. The information is viewed on a screen. It's information that we receive electronically from the law enforcement data system maintained by Oregon State Police. And the information is not even printed out. If it is printed out, there are requirements under the law for that information to be destroyed within a specified time frame. So we wouldn't be keeping criminal records on file for individuals. And if we did choose to continue our investigation based on the report and to pass the point of the initial report, then the individual would be receiving written notice of that the check had been run and of their rights under the law.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So we're talking about a couple questions here. We're talking about a LEDS report?
Yes, that's correct.
Is that the report we're talking about?
Yes.
Okay, and then so the report, the background check can be done and I would never know it. DHS can make a background. What I want to make clear in my mind here is that you, because of a phone call that the representative made about me, you do a background check on me, and I'll never know that happened if you decided that there was no case involved here. Is that what I'm hearing?
If the department chose not to continue its investigation and decided that the allegation did not warrant investigation, and if part of that decision was looking at the criminal records of the person that was the subject of the allegation, then yes, you are correct. The person would not know that abuse had been reported, or that the department did any kind of investigation, including the checking of criminal background checks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger. Sure.
The amendment refers to, on page 2, delete lines 16 through 40. It appears there's a lot in there. What are we doing here?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, most of what's in that section of the bill is just reprinting what's already in the statute. The only actual change in that section is on line 39, where it, excuse me, on line 36, where it talks about a small deletion from this section of ORS 418.016. Most of that section is just a reprint of what's already in the statute. The change is fairly minor. That was proposed by this section of the bill, and it was meant to reflect a change in the federal code as a result of the passage of the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act of 2006. And the Adam Walsh Act is something that's going to affect a number of state agencies, not just the Department of Human Services. And so the decision is made to have the affected agencies meet and coordinate their response to the federal changes. And so as that until that work is completed, we're seeking a deletion of that that language from this particular bill.
You may. I don't know how many people sitting here understood what you said. I don't. And I would like to have a discussion with the department a little bit more in depth as to what is going on here by removing that before we move this bill out.
Chairman Pearson, Representative Krieger, I could explain it more specifically that what this change in Section 2 amounts to is that one of the provisions in the Adam Walsh Child Protection Safety Act that was passed in July is a requirement that public child welfare agencies adhere to language in the federal code that directs how criminal history is handled in the context of approving people to either adopt children or to become foster parents of children. And previously in the federal code, there was an allowance for states to opt out of the federal requirements. And Oregon took advantage of that opt-out provision in the federal law. And we opted out of the federal requirements. And in order to do that, the federal law required action of the legislature to specifically insert language in statute specifying that Oregon opted out of the federal requirements for criminal background checks for foster parents and adoptive parents. As a result of the Adam Walsh legislation that passed in July of 2006, that opt-out provision has been removed from the federal code. And so it appears that states that previously opted out no longer have that option. And therefore, this amendment, or this section of the bill, was meant to eliminate that opt-out language from our statute to reflect the change in the federal law and essentially bring Oregon under the federal requirements for federal background or for criminal background checks for foster and adoptive applicants. But as I mentioned, the law also has other impacts on other state agencies, and so in an effort to coordinate our response to the Adam Walsh Act, state agencies have been meeting to discuss the overall impact and to coordinate the response.
Members, so I think what I would suggest, I think it's unlikely, in fact, I think we can safely say we're not going to move this bill today, but I would like to get input from the other witness who signed up, Andrea Meyer from the ACLU, and Mr.
Gilmore,
if you would stay there just in case there's any response that you need to offer up and to the comments we have here.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. And I appreciate, I wanted to first mention that Mr. Gilmore in his testimony earlier mentioned that he shared this with others and due process concerns, and I do thank him. It was the ACLU. And I certainly appreciate the work that they do, and it's tremendously difficult. The committee's raised a number, it's done some good issues for the. I want to raise just one concern we have, which is sort of the premise. I worry that what's going on is a lack of sufficient funds to truly investigate the calls that merit investigation And so we're shortcutting a little bit by doing the criminal history background to make a determination of whether we go forward an investigation. And we and others worry about that tool because, as you all know, many people have never been swept into the criminal justice system who are engaged in illegal behavior, and we would not want those to be missed because they didn't have a previous criminal history, or those who do to be somehow rising to the top. The investigation should be evaluated based on a more on the evidence coming forward and a site visit. We are troubled with the issue that Representative Cameron identified, which is that people could be subject to a criminal history background check and never receive notice. We are troubled by the issue that Representative Bonamici identified, that it goes beyond the individual who may be the identified by the call or the information provided to the agency, but to those who reside in or frequent. I'm not sure how the agency gets that information. That sounds like they would probably need to do some investigation, and might it be more appropriate that they focus on actually the investigation rather than finding out who might reside and frequent the place and then going and doing a criminal history background. If they actually get into the investigation, then they can give notice at that time to the persons. And with a little bit more sort of, for lack of a better word, probable cause that that person might be involved in some activity going on there that is raising the concern. So those, and then just generally what happens to the documents and the material in these files if the investigation goes forward a little bit but then is closed. So I know they'll get notice if the investigation takes that next step, but if it then closes, we're concerned about just a broadening collection by the government of criminal histories that will be residing in files. So that those are our concerns. I do appreciate some of the additions in the language to this proposal on page 2 to kind of address some of our due process concerns. Thank you. I'll answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Ms. Brennan? Representative Barker.
I've done probably hundreds of criminal history checks without notifying people. I mean, it's part of my work in the police department. I mean, I run things and look at the CCHs, which were a little more restrictive. I see your concern. I don't quite share that. In that, they're just taking a look at it. Here's a call. They don't even probably won't even go out there, but they just take a brief look, just a snapshot, and they see. And I agree, they could certainly miss some crime going on, but it might also call their attention. Yeah, that is like the child molester who wrote me from prison saying he doesn't think these laws really. He thinks child abuse laws are draconian because he's really a nice guy at heart. And so they might see him and say, well, maybe we better take another look at the coach and see how he's doing now.
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, I mean, I sort of have two answers. One is just sort of the progressive slippery slope of all of this kind of information that we are using and being able to get on individuals who we don't have individualized suspicion. And the second response is I assume when you're doing it, you have a little bit more individualized suspicion that that person may be engaged in illegal behavior. We're talking about not just the person who may be the alleged perpetrator, so there's at least some basis or tie that something's gone in, and if it had come to law enforcement, you might have, you know, reasonable suspicion to then go forward, but we're expanding it to those who reside and not necessarily connected. And so, you know, how far do we want to go? It's a policy decision. There's another bill I'll be testifying on. There's just a continued expansion. And so I just always want to raise that concern as you make these decisions, and they oftentimes sound really acceptable, and there's really good policy reasons, but we just keep advancing and advancing on these issues, and I ask the committee to be critical when you look at these decisions.
I appreciate you bringing those concerns forward.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Ms. Meyer, and I take all of your comments for consideration. But with the example of the alleged perpetrator, and I think at some point it was discussed, supposing that the phone call has come in and the allegation is that there are children in a home or a residence that are being sexually abused, no one is necessarily named, and how then do you go about addressing or investigating? There's no specific alleged perpetrator, but there are numbers of individuals who may reside in or frequent a premise. So
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, I just want to call your attention to the fact that that allegation should be thoroughly investigated, and upon arriving or pursuing the investigation, they can and will do a criminal history check on everyone. So, you know, as Mr. Gilmore testified, they have that authority to address your concern. What we're talking about is doing it maybe before we've even collected enough information to know that there's a reasonable basis. We certainly wouldn't, you know, again, my concern is that they're kind of using it to evaluate where to investigate, where you and I might agree that if they get a call like that, they should investigate, period. And as a result of investigating, they will have the authority to do that relatively quickly in the process. So it's a timing issue for us, and a concern that it might, if they do that check, they get the same phone call, and they find no criminal history. I would want them to as thoroughly check that at claim out as if they did find a criminal history. So I'm worried that the absence of a criminal history on people might eliminate or reduce the intent, the need to do the investigation. I would think if there's sufficient evidence, they're going to go investigate, and I hope they will. And my concern, again, is because of the funding and resources, that there might be a reluctance, an inability to investigate everything. And we would hope they would investigate everything appropriately and not jump the gun by a criminal history check. Does that make sense? I mean, sure. Thoroughly investigate any claims. We certainly want all our children to be safe.
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores. I would just say that I agree with the notion, and the department would certainly support the notion that a determination about whether or not to investigate a reported child abuse should never be based solely on any one piece of information, any one piece of evidence. And in most cases in any case where you have a credible report, where you have enough factual information and enough observation on the part of the reporter to determine that there is a significant possibility that children are at risk of harm, then certainly we'd investigate regardless of what a criminal history report says about the alleged perpetrator or other people at the location of the report. However, there are times when that criminal history information is critical and may be the deciding factor, when the information reported by the caller is inconclusive, vague, doesn't really give us enough. And it's true, we do not have the resources to personally investigate every single call that the department receives on its child abuse hotlines. And so we do have to prioritize calls and to weigh the information that we receive. And there are definitely times when a person's criminal past will be a significant factor in making that determination. Not just the fact of a criminal history, but how recent that criminal history is, how severe that criminal history is, and what the nexus is between that criminal history and child safety. Thank you.
So, Cameron, did you have a question?
Just maybe a comment. And I understand and appreciate the tough job that DHS has to do in investigating these things. My biggest concern here probably is that there's just not some sort of a notification that we're doing these background checks on people. And I think that if there's a way we could, once the case is closed or you've made a I probably need to understand how you do those investigations more thoroughly. But once an investigation has been made towards a case, let's say towards me, and you never contact me, I understand you're not going to contact me because you don't want to alert me, but at some point in time I would think you made a decision not to pursue this. I guess I might want to know that I was being investigated for a particular situation or crime, or that a background check was pulled on me because of something, and not for retribution, but just I guess to know that that's going on around me. That's my concern with the bill, is that I've been involved over the last 3 years now with fingerprinting and background checks, and we have to have a balance of doing a job and protecting the employees and protecting the children, but also protecting the rights of our citizens to some sort of a privacy. So that's my biggest concern with this issue.
Senator Wisnik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gilmore, I think with your proposed amendment to delete lines 16 through 40, then you'd have to delete the last paragraph in the summary, because I think that's...
Yeah, I think the summary would be modified when they reprint the bill in response to an amendment.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. If there are no further questions, we're not going to move the bill today, and so if there are no further questions for these witnesses, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2179 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2252. We have Greg Malkasian from here as our first witness.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Malkasian. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And with me today is our Chief of Human Resources, Salvador Jarenas, and he will be providing the testimony for the department. This bill is an important effort that we have as a department to protect Oregonians against identity theft. And if it's permissible, Mr. Jarenas will provide the testimony.
Thank you. Please.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committees, I am Salvador Llerenas, Chief Human Resources Officer with the Department of Consumer Business Services. I'm here to testify on support of House Bill 2252. House Bill 2252 will grant the authority to the agencies included in the bill to conduct nationwide fingerprint-based criminal record checks through the Federal Bureau of Investigation. This bill is part of an effort to protect Oregonians against identity theft. During the 2005 legislative session, House Bill 2157 granted many agencies the statutory authority to conduct these nationwide background checks. DCBS was not included in the bill. DCBS is Oregon's largest business regulatory agency, and many of our employees have extensive access to financial, personal identifiable information, cash collection, and computer systems. For example, our banks and insurance examiners have tax and financial information, loan records, and similar materials from the banks, credit unions, and other financial services business they examine. These records contain sensitive personal information such as names, addresses, social security numbers, and account information. Likewise, our workers' compensation division maintains names, addresses, social security numbers on approximately 800,000 injured workers. Our building codes division licenses approximately 42,000 electricians, plumbers, and others in the construction industry, and collect similar personal identifiable information. A top priority of Governor Kulongoski and his consumer protection agenda is identity theft. Recently, we have been involved with a working group that is developing legislation to address identity theft. Through this process, we have come to realize the potential risk associated with the misuse of the considerable sensitive information to which we have access. We have an obligation to safeguard this information, and Oregonians have the right to know that their information is safe with us. We believe having the ability to conduct nationwide fingerprint background checks is an integral part in protecting personal information, cash collections, and information systems. We currently have the authority through the Law Enforcement Data System, or LEDS, to check Oregon criminal background of applicants. The limitation of this approach is that with the mobility of today's workforce, we do have employees and applicants for employment who have lived in other states. And the Let's Checks, or the system, captures mainly Oregon-based information. So being able to conduct nationwide fingerprint background checks on positions in our agency, then have this type of broad access to personal identifiable information, will help us to protect Oregonians from identity theft. House Bill 2252 will also allow the Department of Consumer Business Services the authority to conduct these checks on persons who are applying for a license as an insurance adjuster, insurance consultants, insurance producers, a life settlement provider, or a life settlement broker. These licensees have a fiduciary relationship with their customers. Federal law prohibits applicants with felony convictions from obtaining any insurance license without a waiver. And again, with, we currently have the ability through the authority to check criminal background checks of these applicants through the LED system. However, once again, the limitation is in the LED system captures Oregon-based information. In addition to the Department of Consumer Business Services, this bill would allow the Board of Radiologic Technology, Commission of the Blind, Real Estate Agency, and the Office of Private Health Partnership to conduct nationwide fingerprint-based background checks through the FBI. This authority would enable screening of specified persons who are employed by or applying for employment with the agency, or those that provide services or seek to provide services to the agency as contractors, vendors, or volunteers. This bill will also allow the Board of Radiologic Technology to conduct these checks for persons applying for or renewing license, as well as individuals under investigation. Although the specific issues of each agency may differ somewhat, the other agencies included in this bill face circumstances similar to DCBS. Each of the agencies included in this bill are present and available to answer any questions. In addition to the agencies I have listed, there are a few other agencies that have identified the need to act to have a similar authority. We may be proposing appropriate amendments to include those agencies in the bill. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have. And again, we ask for your support of House Bill 2252.
Any questions from the committee? So, if I understand correctly, this will apply to people who are applying to work for your for the consumer business services, and also some of the people who are licensed, like plumbers, or is that did I get that right?
Mr. Vice Chair, this bill would apply for some of our current employees, for people seeking employment with the agency, and also for insurance, for people seeking licenses as an insurance adjusters or consultants, or insurance producers, or typically known as agents.
Okay, I'm a little surprised to hear that, because my wife had an insurance license back in the 60s, and she had to be fingerprinted for that back then. Have they discontinued that now, or for a period? Or?
Vice Chair, with your permission, I'll have Mr. Malkasian answer that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Greg Malkasian again. And we actually do collect the fingerprint at this time. The specific fingerprint isn't used because it's done through the process of the identification through the law enforcement data system.
Okay. So then what you want to do is run this on a national. You want to have check them nationally.
I guess Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I noticed that it would also permit fingerprinting vendors and volunteers, and I wonder if you could talk about the circumstances under which you may take fingerprints for a vendor. Thank you.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Bonamici, the many of our vendors and our volunteers have access to some of the information. So they may come in contact with this information, and we want to be able to have that protection available, the safeguards to protect information is available to us.
Might you be willing to provide an example of a vendor? I just want to understand under what circumstances. I can see a vendor as somebody who comes in and delivers water or something, but can you give me an example of a vendor who would have access to the information that's sensitive? Thank you.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Bonamici, I'll pass to Mr. Malkasian.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, Greg Malkasian again. And we may hire a contractor to do some data analysis, and they could possibly have access to information systems or a tremendous amount of records. Mr. Zarinas had indicated, 800,000 injured workers' records with Social Security numbers. If they were a vendor that would have that type of access, we would likely want to assure that there weren't a circumstance that could be abused for identity theft purposes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one more follow-up. Yes. Thank you for indulging me. As somebody who serves on the Consumer Protection Committee and is very concerned about identity theft, I just want to make sure that we're implementing the safeguards that we need to and not missing opportunities that we should be. So I'm just wondering if you're going to implement rules. How is the decision going to be made about who to fingerprint?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Bonamici, under existing law, ORS 181.534, we are required, and we would establish through rules the scope of the check. It will be the opportunity to have an appeal process also included for those checks that we would conduct. At BCBS, we have identified all the different positions and have access to sensitive information. We currently have about 1,079 positions, and we have identified in about 771 of those, or 70%, have access to information then we would be seeking to protect or be the scope of this bill.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you. Ms. Meyer?
Good morning. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. Like the previous bill, I want to thank DCBS. They did reach out and contact me and discuss this. I have to say this must be very familiar for Representative Cameron because we worked tirelessly last session on a bill, and I wanted to at least touch on some of the history on this for us and bring it into context. Historically, the ACLU has been very concerned about requiring FBI fingerprint criminal background checks as a condition of employment or contracting, volunteering, and state licensing because it assumes individuals are guilty and must prove their innocence. In addition, it provides fingerprints to the FBI of innocent people, which raises questions and concerns about how the prints may be used and whether or not they're being retained. So because of these concerns, since 1991, when this legislation first began in its infancy in Oregon, ACLU has urged safeguards ensuring that prints are returned and destroyed by the state agency and that the FBI not retain any facsimile or electronic copy for those with no criminal record. Historically, the FBI has investigated and kept files on lawful political activities of innocent people, and history is recent there, too, because the FBI has collected over 1,100 pages on the ACLU since 9/11. Unfortunately, recent years, fingerprints have been transmitted through computer scanning, which makes them subject to unintended release or hacking, and making it easier for the FBI to retain copies without the knowledge of state officials. In other words, in the old days, our fingerprints were put on the cards were sent, the cards were returned, but now it's all done by electronic scanning. So the safeguards that we have wanted are we hope there, but we're still concerned, and the Oregon State Police is here today, and I would renew our request once again that we really get in writing, and Patricia Witzel knows this, and we've talked about this, that the FBI is still complying with Oregon's requirement that when we send fingerprints to them, they are not retaining them. Because one of the purposes of the criminal justice system is to encourage reformation of criminals, especially those who commit offenses when they were very young, we are concerned the increasing use of criminal background checks will be used to discriminate against individuals who have truly reformed. Therefore, we have urged that there be a nexus between specific jobs and occupations and the type of criminal offenses that might act as a bar to employment or licensing, and I think Representative Bonamici touched on that. And there is statute. What we have in the statute provisions is some narrowing language, and I'll talk about that briefly, but we've asked the agencies come in and not just say, we can do anyone we want, let us trust us to decide by rulemaking, but instead each agency we are encouraged to, what is it, for what purpose, what type of employees do you need, set that forth in the statute, and then by rulemaking, make a further determination of really what the occupations are and what your concerns in terms of criminal history is, so that someone who had a drug charge 25 years ago is still able to do the job, but if you've got someone who's got recent fraud, they might not be ones who we do want handling the money. So that there's that nexus between the actual criminal history and the employment. Because of the sensitive nature and errors contained in criminal history files, we've insisted on due process protections that allow subjects of required criminal background checks to challenge the accuracy of the resulting reports, and I think that was talked about here. So again, and it's in another part of the law that you will get your copy, there's a process for which if it's incorrect that you can hopefully get that clarified. Because that's always a concern. Errors happen. Finally, we've urged safeguards to prevent the broad dissemination of individual criminal histories in order to prevent discrimination, embarrassment, or other things as people move forward in their lives. So we have specific safe concerns. We still are concerned about the number of individuals swept under this law is vastly growing, and we remain concerned about limiting language in the statutes. Because it certainly at some point may be so broad that it looks like it's limiting, but it's really anyone they want, and that worries us. 2 years ago, we did ask for a better understanding of the number of persons subject to the requirements, and there were all the agencies joining, and unfortunately then, none of the agencies really had the numbers, and we think it's time maybe for we would hope the legislature to get a report. My understanding is they actually haven't even done the rulemaking yet, but to get a report on what kind of numbers we're talking about, what's really happening with this, and kind of get an update on that. We'd urge that to happen as well. Another safeguard and a concern that I will raise in concluding, in the past, you know, one of the primary safeguards by the Oregon State Police, in return for authorizing the agencies and departments to use the LED system terminals for statewide background checks, was to audit the use of those terminals to prevent abuse by employees using those secure terminals. And unfortunately, again, with fewer resources to the Oregon State Police, there have been fewer auditors, and so we just remain concerned about, as we enlarge these systems, that we also have the necessary checks in place and the necessary resources for those who must do those checks. Obviously there's going to be folks added, and we've talked to them about trying to narrow the language. I want to at least highlight a concern, and it's actually no fault per se of the parties before you today, because I suspect this was similar language was contained in 2157, that huge bill last session. But if you look at House Bill 2252, and you'll look at lines 25 through 28, it talks about when an employee or contractor or vendor has access to personal information about employees or members of the public, including, and so I want to emphasize what's not written there. When we have that kind of language, it means including but not limited to Social Security numbers, dates of birth, driver's license numbers, medical information, personal financial information, or criminal background information. I think most of that's meritorious. What worries me is the including language, because it means it could be other things, and other agencies in the future deciding that they want to be able to do that when someone has access to information that's really not confidential. So it doesn't truly kind of honor the narrowing language. Social Security numbers, medical information, I wonder about dates of birth, if someone only had access to people's dates of birth, whether that is someone we need to do a criminal history on. But I'm happy for the committee now or over on the other side, but I've talked to the agencies about kind of limiting that language and maybe at least removing the including, so we know they've articulated what the kind of information would be that they would subject someone to that. So with that said, I appreciate the opportunity today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Meyer? Thank you. This bill appears to need to be designed to protect the public. They're asking fingerprint employees who have access to this to vital information, and I agree a date of birth alone isn't anything, but people then build on those. I mean, that's the same thing. They'll get a piece of this and a piece of that for the identity theft. But also just the confidentiality that Ms. Meyer spoke so eloquently about for all citizens would especially apply to people who are, for example, on disability, workers' comp, that these records are there and that shouldn't be out for whoever, just anybody, and I know she'd be the first one to protect that. And I hear her concerns, and I know they'll be looked at again when it gets to the other side of the building if this gets there. And that being said, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2250. I'll close the hearing and open a work session and would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Chair. First, I would like to comment, if you don't mind. Thank you. I think that as I'm understanding this is moving from Oregon only to nationwide due to the migratory nature of workforce and to kind of capture and corral the opportunities for gauging. And so I'm very happy to move House Bill 2252 to the floor of the House recommendation.
Any further comments or discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm still a little concerned about the I'm unclear on whether rules have already been drafted regarding who's going to make a decision about who. There's a lot of people out there who fall within this, and I'm not really clear. I seem to recall some conflicting testimony about there are rules and there will be, there aren't rules about who's going to make the decision about who gets fingerprinted. And so I understand the intent of it, but I'm just not comfortable at this point knowing that it's going to be.
It was my understanding in your testimony that they're going to be fingerprinting their employees, and if somebody has a vendor contract that will be in and have access to all that information, they will be checked as well. And what they want to do is obviously the criminal background nationally, because as we know, people not only accidentally move from one spot to another, but will intentionally move trying to conceal their.
No, I understand the employee part. It's just that my concern about it also applies to vendors and volunteers and contractors, yeah. And it's just everybody who's a vendor and a volunteer and a contractor, everybody can be fingerprinted. Who's going to make that determination, and are there going to be rules about that? So.
Mr. Chair, if I can comment, being the resident 2157, House Bill 2157 expert on the committee, and spending probably over 100 hours last session on this issue with Ms. Myers and probably 30 agencies. There are some concerns from the standpoint of we're trusting agencies to make these rules and to determine what employees, what volunteers, what vendors they're going to ask to be to put in the rules to have background checks. And there's a balance here of I think holding agencies accountable and responsible for doing the right thing and checking the right people. But I want to give just a little bit of history of why we're here. These groups did not get included in 2157. Had they been here last session, we wouldn't even be looking at this bill and talking about it. That doesn't mean the issues that are being raised here don't need to be looked at, and I asked the speaker to have an interim work group on this whole issue to see how our state's handling this and make sure that we're doing it in an appropriate way. So I just want to clarify that these agencies are being asked to be brought into a bill that was a very inclusive bill last session, and there are some safeguards that Ms. Myers referred to about, you know, if I don't agree with my background check and those types of things. But I remember sitting in three different committees and seeing three different bills and thinking about, we didn't even have the authority, our medical board examiners didn't have the authority to do FBI background checks, and we had a doctor come from Florida to Oregon and go on to wherever it was, Australia. And that's what got this thing going, and now we're down to vendors coming in that are going to have ID. So it does need to be, you know, there's a lot of trust being put in agencies to not fingerprint the janitor who doesn't have access to a computer or whatever to do that. So we need to, I think, I want to recommend we move this to the House floor and get it done for these agencies. And if there's somewhere down the road we can look at this as a bigger issue and the details within our state, I'd say that.
Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Bonamici?
No.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Cox?
Aye.
Representative Krueger?
Aye.
Representative Reed, excused. Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. Would somebody like to be the carrier?
He's the most knowledgeable.
Cameron.
Okay. Sure, I'll.
Cameron. Representative Cameron will be the carrier.
I'll hold my fingers up on the floor.
Okay. Okay, close the work session on 2252, and with no further business before us and behind schedule, adjourn.
Good.